So I'd like to welcome everyone to the first quantum information seminar of this new academic year. We're very pleased to welcome Sepah Nazami from Caltech to give the first seminar. And Sepah did his PhD at Stanford, and he's now a postdoc at Caltech. Please take it away.
Thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me. It's great to talk here. Can you guys confirm that you can hear me fine before starting?
Yeah, okay,
that's perfect. Thank you. So today I'm going to talk about the permanent of random matrices from representation theory. But this is more of a math probability talk, but I will connect it to interesting things in quantum information science as well. So let me start with some motivation, and the main motivation, and the first part of the motivation comes from random matrix theory. So we all know that random matrix theory has been very, very successful in computing a lot of quantities of interest. For example, we can compute the average of product of matrix elements. This is something that we very commonly do in quantum information science when you look at designs and other things. The relevant tools are Schur-Weil duality or Weingarten calculus. So the other type of quantities that physicists are in particular very interested in, and many other random matrix theory people, in addition to those who do connections of topology and algebra, are things like eigenvalue distributions. They have been precisely computed and for many cases, and we know for example, the level of spacing distributions and all, tons of other interesting quantities. We have also been able to compute more complex quantities derived from random matrices, for example, the distribution of the determinant of random matrices for many different ensembles. And there have been historically many interesting questions, like the computing the probability of the determinant vanishing, that have attracted interest in math community. So with that background, I'm going to talk about the case of permanence of random matrices. And this is a case where you have a complex quantity derived from random matrices, which is not well understood at all. One reason is that permanent is sum of an exponential number of terms. So if you remember, the expansion of permanence is like the determinant. You have all this permuted diagonals, but we don't have this minus one, this sign factor behind the individual monomials. You can compute each monomial separately using the things like Weingarten calculus, but in general, the permanent has many terms, so it just prohibits you from actually computing using the normal techniques for computing the product of matrix elements. The other reason that permanents are hard is that permanent is not geometric, unlike the determinant. Determinant means it has some geometric meaning. It's just a volume of a particular polytope, and that helps you in computing distribution of random permanents, random determinants. But it's not the case for the permanents. And the other reason that this case is really hard is that getting a sense, but you cannot even sample from the distribution of random permanents, because computing a permanent of a large matrix is known to be computationally hard, even in the average case. So it's not the case that you say, oh, I don't know how this distribution looks like, but I can at least simulate it on a computer and see have a sense of how it behaves. It's just really hard to compute in any case. So for all these reasons, very little is known about the distribution of permanent of random matrices. And the other type of area of interest, the other part of the motivation comes from the quantum supremacy in computer science. So we start with the task of boson sampling, which is a proposal for quantum supremacy using linear optics. And in the background, it's really based on the hardness of the computation of a permanent of random matrices. And if you look at the paper by Aronson and Arkhipov, it really relies on one particular conjecture, which is called the anti-concentration conjecture for the pyramid of random matrices. And it's a conjecture that's stated here, which basically tells you that the probability of the permanent squared, absolute value of permanent squared, when the matrix elements of M are random Gaussian, random complex Gaussian numbers, the probability of this permanent being smaller than some epsilon, smaller sometimes k factorial, I will just like tell you that the k factorial is actually the average of permanent squared. So the probability of being an epsilon fraction of an average is bounded polynomially for some constant powers and prefactors. So it basically, the conjecture, anti-concentration conjecture, tells us that the permanent should not have significant weight near the origin. It should not be sharply, the distribution should not be sharply peaked near the origin. And this is the conjecture behind boson sampling. We have some results, more or less in the same sense. The best result known is a result by Terry Tao and Van Vu. It shows a much, much weaker one. It doesn't prove anything polynomial, but it shows that the probability of permanent being near the very close to the origin will eventually vanish if you increase the size of the matrices. So, and the original result of Tao and Wu was for plus one random matrices, while for anti-concentration conjecture, we need this is a stronger result for complex Gaussian random matrices. And it's known that you can tweak their proof from the plus minus one matrix ensembles to complex matrix ensembles. So there's no issue with the matrix ensemble, but just the technique of the proving of this proof is not powerful enough to prove to give us the actual anti-concentration conjecture. And besides this quantum information application, it has been very interesting. Permanents show up in many interesting CS problems. For example, it counts the number of perfect matchings in a graph. And in general, so with all this motivation, we want to understand the distribution of permanents of random matrices. And the tool I'm going to use here is representation theory. I will give you a quick table of the results that we are going to prove. I'm going to talk about. We are going to study the permanent of random matrices, and in particular, two different ensembles. The first ensemble is an ensemble of k by k complex IID Gaussian matrices, but each individual matrix elements is a complex Gaussian with variance one and mean zero. Or the ensemble of k by k submatrices of d by d unitary matrices. So you can have your huge unitary matrix or just your large unitary matrix, and you look at the submatrix of that and you compute its permanent. And you look at the distribution of that permanent. And our goal is to compute the 2t moment of the permanent distribution. You look at the absolute value, you raise it to the power of 2t, and you look at this expectation value. So in this talk, I'm trying to understand the distribution by understanding its moments. It's the simplest approach. And to bound or to compute this particular moment, we use representation theory and combinatorics to provide an expansion formula for the permanent moments. And with this formula, we prove a surprising duality. We showed that the surprising size moment duality, and we showed that you can always swap the moment and the size of the matrix in this kind of formula. So the 2t moment of permanent of k by k matrices is always equal to the 2k moment of a permanent of t by t matrices. And this is a useful fact to know if you want to compute the permanent small moments of permanents of large matrices, because permanent of large matrices are famously hard to compute. So you can just swap the moment and size and compute the quantity of interest. And we develop an algorithm to compute a lot of moments explicitly. And next thing, our main result is a proven strong lower bound for the moments of permanence. And then we provide evidence and argue that the lower bound is actually close to saturation. So we, the lower bound that we prove is really not off, is not really a bad estimate of the actual moments. And we prove this for all K and T, for all moments and all matrix sizes. And with this kind of conjectures and lower bounds, we compute the tail of the log permanent distribution using large deviation theory. So we get some information of how the permanent decays, how the distribution permanence decays as we increase matrix size. And we leave some comments on boson sampling. So just one quick comment about the last point, one to the last point that we compute the tail of the distribution. Remember that for the anti-concentration conjecture, we needed the distribution near the origin. So for, but what I can actually compute is the tail of the distribution. So it is, I wanted to compute the distribution near the origin, but I couldn't. And instead, I could get some quantitative result about the other side of the distribution. But I'm hopeful that the techniques that have been developed here can be used for to extend these results until the origin. So for this reason, the anti-concentration conjecture is not resolved by this paper. Is there any question at this point?
Professor, there's a question in the chat from Sam Winnick who says, these results hold for both real matrices and for complex matrices.
No. The results I'm going to talk about only hold for complex matrices. For example, this size moment duality, the fact that you can, I will talk about it later, but the fact that you can swap a size of a matrix and the moment doesn't hold for real matrices. Okay, thank you.
So actually, so what do you mean by you compute a lot of moments, like you can compute some bound for some value of k and t.
No, I mean, I will go through that. Maybe a lot is an exaggeration, so I will exactly tell you what they can compute.
But essentially means like for some range of k and t, you can compute things, or.
And for all range of K and T, I can bound by, you can compute the moments up to a small multiplicative factor for every K and T. But for K equal to 3 or 4 or T equal to 3 and 4 and just K smaller than maybe 100, I can explicitly compute the exact number. And those are also, I think, new results. So for smaller cases, you can actually exactly compute this, and you see that the lower bounds that you prove are nicely match the exact results. And these are, I will also talk about it, but you need to do something other than actually computing the average. That would converge very slowly. So you have to use it kind of a different technique.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. But I will talk about all of these points. So let me start with the case of complex Gaussian matrices, and I will talk about the case of submatrices of random unitary matrices later near the end of the talk. So that would be shorter. So now I start with some combinatorial approach. What I have in this slide is mostly simple algebra. It's not really important to explicitly follow that, but I just want to send a message that this calculation is not really hard. So we start with the case of K by K random complex Gaussian matrices, and we are interested in the two-theta moment of the absolute value of permanent square. So we are interested in this quantity when permanent is famously expanded in terms of monomials that you see here. And we are interested in permanent to the power of t, and we can be just like very boring and multiply this right-hand side t times by itself. And you see that it would become the permanent will be expanded in terms of a sum over some kind of index table that we'll explain below, and the product of the monomials that you get here. So each one of this table, this index table, is basically a combination of is a table of t permutations of numbers 1 to k. So the first column is the permutation that comes from the first factor of the paramount. The second column is the permutation that the monomial specifies the monomial coming of the second factor of paramount, and so on until the tth column is the tth factor of the permutation. And you just like choose the indices from this table, and that would be an expansion of paramount to the power of t. And so the main thing that I want you to remember is this k by t table, which somehow it plays an important role in our calculation. And now if you actually look at the absolute value squared of this quantity and you do a little bit of math and you just like play with it a little bit, you get the following results. So this is our first theorem for the paramount of random Gaussian matrices. It says that let R and C be rope-preserving and column-preserving permutations of a K by T grid. So let me explain what these things are. So you have this K by T table, a table of K rows and T columns. You can permute, and there are KT cells in this table, and you can permute these cells. So the group SKT acts on this, the permutation group of KT elements, or the group SKT, acts on this table. This group has two specific subgroups. The subgroup that permutes the rows is called preserving permutation. It has T factor to the power of K elements. And you also have the column preserving subgroup, which we call C, which has K factorial to the power of T elements. Then the theorem is the following. The average of the paramount to the power of 2t is equal to the number of solutions of R1, C1, R2, C2 being equal to identity. So you just pick one rope-preserving permutation, multiply by column-preserving permutation, multiply by rope-preserving permutation, multiply by column-preserving permutation. And you do this task, and the number of times that you get identity, you hit identity, you identity permutation is exactly equal to the paramount to the power of 2t. And so at this point, is there any questions? Is this kind of important to understand this theorem?
I think I should try to understand this more. So can you go over one slide and maybe explain a bit more about like the construction of this, what is it, the LKT? So is it just you define it nice way that so that this matches with, so this T means it's really just power of T?
Yes. So this is a permanent to the power of t, and I'm just like really doing nothing but expanding this, the first term is identified by a permutation, and the second, which is so if you look at the when j is 1, you get m I l I 1. And but Li1s are permutations of numbers 1 and k, 1 to k. So this is really the first factor of the permanent.
When t is equal to 1, it's just permutations?
Yes.
Right? So, yes,
exactly.
Okay. So then...
But...
Oh, okay. I think I got it.
But yeah, from yeah. going... Yeah, but going from here to this theorem, I actually did some non-trivial that I really didn't talk about, but and that's basically you have to look at the when you compute the moments of individual Gaussians, you get some combinatorial factors that it's not hard to see, but it's, you can just really see that the average permanent gets a nicer form in terms of it's very symmetric between rows and columns. And you have to
Did you define
row preserving column.
Mm-hmm. Did you define delta, or what was delta?
Delta is just delta.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So
yeah, it's R1, just a good boring delta. Sorry.
So R and C. So you pick R and C. Oh, I see. Okay. I see.
So it's just like like a Markov chain. You just row permute, column permute, row permute, column permute, and see if you get identity or not.
I see.
And and that happens to be equal to the moment of permanence. So it's not immediately obvious from this slide, but it's kind of the same nature. So starting from this simple formula, you can have a sense of how you can have some intuitive understanding of how moments of permanence should grow. So we can look at, so this is exactly the same formula that we have in the previous slide, and I can factor out the number of permutations, number of row and column preserving permutations. So number of row preserving permutations was k factor to the power of t. Number of column preserving permutations was t factor to the power of k. And then can have this prefactor and write it as an average over row preserving, column preserving, row preserving, and column preserving permutations become equal to identity. But now we can speculate that if you choose row, column preserving permutations randomly, and when you multiply that, the resulting distribution would be more or less uniform. So it would be a random member of the permutation group, SKT. So now we are basically speculating that this two-four-step Markov process, row and column mixing, really produces for you a more or less a uniform distribution over all permutations in SKT. So if that's the case, then we say that the probability of obtaining identity is 1 over the number of permutations in SKT. So we conclude that intuitively, I will give more rigorous reasons later, but we conclude that intuitively, the average of permanence to the power of 2t is nothing but a k factorial to the power of 2t, t factorial to the power of 2k divided by kt factorial. And so this is some intuitive results based on the fact that this process should be highly mixing. And we will see that this is not a bad estimate for the permanent moments. Is there any question for this slide? So if not, I will talk about the size moment duality for a bit. So this is a restatement of the theorem that I have in a couple of slides ago and also in last slide. But you can see that the right-hand side of this theorem, this sum, is really symmetric between rows and columns. So you can easily change k and t in your k by t grid. You can just transpose your grid, and the result would exactly be the same. So this immediately shows you that for the permanent case, you can swap moment and size of the matrices. So so this is the first line. And it's kind of surprising because this size moment duality does not hold for class bond matrices. It doesn't hold for real Gaussian matrices. And the only other case that I know such a duality exists is a determinant of random complex Gaussian matrices. So the determinant and permanent have these properties, but no other distributions that we know. And the same type of, except for the, that's the same type of duality holds for the submatrices of random unitary matrices. For this second ensemble, that I will talk about, miners of random unitary matrices, will also have this very interesting property. And the proof is a bit harder there. And this can simplify the calculation of the small moments of large matrices, as I explained in answer to Penny's question a couple of slides ago. And so is there any question here? So if not, I will talk about a little bit about the representation theory and how representation theory helps us calculate these quantities. So this is going to be one slide detour of reminding representation theory and how it works, but then I will go through the main point very quickly in the next slide. So just to remind you, representation of a group is just like a map from the group elements to this space of matrices. So this row here is a map from abstract group elements to some matrix space. And the point is that they preserve the matrix product. So row of G times row of H is equal to row of GH. And we know that the representation of matrices often decomposed to smaller irreducible representations. So you can write any, you can write your favorite representation in terms of a direct sum of a smaller representation. And you can do that until you cannot decompose representations further. And those representations that cannot be decomposed are called irreducible representations, or for short, IREPs. And in this talk, we are interested in IREPs of the unitary group and the symmetric group, and they both happen to be indexed by the same objects, which are called Young diagrams. So the Young diagram is nothing but a partition of an integer, which is placed in this, in a funny way, in this kind of ladder, not stereotype diagram. So here, this is a Young diagram of the number 15, of the 15 boxes, and you put the 6 boxes in the first row and the second and 4, 4, and 1 boxes in the other rows. And the number of columns, sorry, the number of rows in each Young diagram is called the depth of the diagram and represented by L of lambda. And with this definition, we index the IREPs of the symmetric group by notation rho lambda of pi. So pi is a symmetric group elements, and this is a particular irreducible representation of the symmetric group. And we index the IREPs of the unitary group by sigma lambda of U. And here you have this little index D, which tells you the dimension of the underlying unitary group. And so with this background, there is one more very interesting representation that any group has, and that's called the regular representation. I'm going to present it for the symmetric group. And the row regular acts very simply on the group elements. So you start with the Hilbert space or with a vector space with dimension equal to kt factorial for the group skt. And you index each one of the basis elements by one of the permutations. So you have ket pi prime being one of your basis elements. And the regular representation acts on these basis elements by just multiplying the indices. So your regular of pi times ket pi prime is ket pi times pi prime. And this regular representation has this very interesting and important property that the trace of regular representation is equal to kt factorial times delta of pi and e. So it is trace for the regular representation, trace is non-zero if and only if the group element is non-identity. And we can use this fact to rewrite our permanent problem. So you have the average of the permanent to the power of 2t equal to this delta function of r1 c1 r2 c2. And now I can rewrite this delta function as 1 over kt factorial times sum over r1 c1 r2 c2. But now instead of this delta, I have trace of rho regular r1 c1 r2 c2. Is this part more or less clear? Is there any question? So this is on nothing but a rewriting of the original delta problem using the regular representation. But now we can use the facts that we know about the regular representation, and in particular how the regular representation decomposes into individual EREFs. And that's something that we know. We know that every EREF of the symmetric group shows up in the regular representation with the degeneracy equal to its dimension. So you can start with this formula that I have here and decompose this row reg into individual irreducible representation. And you see that the terms that appear in the sum, now you have a sum over Young diagrams which index the regular representations. And you have this 1 over KT factorial coefficient that I had before. And because each EREF appears with this factor of its dimension, we have this dimension of a regular irreducible representation here multiplied by this quantity, and this rho lambda is nothing but the regular representation of symmetric group indexed by lambda. And for being more clear, I just misused the notation a little bit, and I used R, speak R and big C instead of sum over all permutations in the group R, and I use big C in terms of sum over all permutations in the group C. Basically, anytime you see big R, it means the sum over all row preserving permutations. Anytime you see C, it means the sum over all column preserving permutations. So now I have, so previously I had this hard problem of computing this right-hand side. Now we have decomposed the sum into simpler objects. And now the quantity that we have to understand is trace of rho lambda RC, RC. So is there any question or is it? So at this point, I can look at these terms, this expansion formula, this equation I call the expansion formula, term by term for the individual, for different lambdas or for different irreducible representations. And most of the paper actually devoted to computing these quantities term by term for this for individual lambdas. And we are not going to talk about this computation, this calculation in this talk, but I'm going to report some of the results. So to start, consider the very first term, when the lambda is nothing but a single row Young diagram of KT boxes. Row lambda of one, row of this lambda, this irreducible representation, is a trivial representation of the permutation group. It assigns number one to each permutation group member. So if you compute this formula for that very first Young diagram, this F lambda is equal to one. And for each element of the row permutation, or for each element of the permutation group, which shows up in this RC, RC expansion, this trace assigns the number one to that permutation because of course we are talking about the trivial representation. So the first term in this expansion becomes number of elements in the row preserving and column preserving permutations to the power of two because we have two of them. So it would be R k factorial to the power of 2t, t factorial to the power of 2k divided by kt factorial. So this is actually this shows that the very first Young diagram contributes k factor to the power of 2t, t factor to the power of 2k divided by kt factorial to the permanent, to the average permanent. So, and if you remember, this factor was a factor that we derived by our intuitive argument a couple of slides ago, which means that the very first Young diagram is actually matching our intuitive estimate of the permanent moments. And now other Young diagrams, we contribute more. So we have to compute the contribution of other Young diagrams to get better and better estimates of the permanent moment.
Oh, question?
Yeah.
So in the formula, you have a constraint. The L of lambda is smaller than mean of KT.
Right.
So where does it come
from? Oh, yes, yes. So. Well, that comes from, I didn't talk about that, but that comes from the fact that you have this R and C subgroups. So you can, so if you can expand this trace of rho lambda of R times rho lambda of C times rho lambda of R times rho lambda of C, because these are representations, and you can see that rho lambda of R, because of this rho preserving permutation, is simply tensor powers of this is just like k tensor power of the symmetric group. So it individual terms, individual rho lambda of R, rho lambda of C don't have support in larger in Young diagrams with more than
I see.
K or T columns. So this term already vanishes over there.
I mean,
I could have not put that here, but this constraint will be useful later when you look at the minors of unitary matrices. But that's a very good question.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. So now you have to do some tricks. The calculation gets harder, but I can actually compute a couple of other Young diagrams. So the first Young diagram that you can study is after the trivial one is that when you put KT minus one boxes in the first column, first row, and only one box in the second row. And you can see that that term is always zero. So that doesn't contribute at all. The next term that you can compute is to put two boxes in the second row and KT minus two boxes in the first row. And in that case, you can see that the contribution, when you compute it using Cauchy identities and other techniques, you see that the contribution of this second term is just like one half of the original contribution of the trivial term. So it's a constant factor, but it's just like only one half of that main term. You can also go, for example, you can put three boxes in the second row, and you see that the contribution is zero again, or subleading in KT. And you can put four boxes, and you see that the contribution is 1/24th. And you can see that as you add more and more boxes in the second row, the contribution decays exponentially. So there are always a constant factor of the original term, but by vanishing prefactors. Computation of Young diagrams with more than two rows is very hard and intractable, but I could also compute just like very few Young diagrams. And you can see that, for example, the main contribution is in the Young diagram with actually two rows in the second, two boxes in the second row, two boxes in the third row, and KT minus four boxes in the first row. And this contribution again is a small fraction, 1/12th of the original factor. And I cannot compute more Young diagrams. The calculation, I mean, even these ones are calculated by computer because the algebra is very complex. And I couldn't find a nice way to actually package them. But the main message is that you can easily see the trend that as you consider Young diagrams with less boxes in the first row, their contribution of those illusory representation in the permanent moment gets very, very small, very, very quickly. So that would suggest that maybe including a few number of boxes, including a few number of irreducer representations that we could actually explicitly compute and have a dominating first row is actually a good estimate of the permanent moment, because you expect that other Young diagrams to contribute significantly less. So that would lead to the following conjecture. If you add like four or five of this Young. Yes, that's please.
How can I say that each term will be positive?
So these are so rho lambda of R is a projector.
Is a sorry what?
And so you is a projector.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, so you have product of a number of projectors, so each term is actually positive.
Okay.
Yeah, that's also a very good question. Thank you. So yeah, so exactly. These terms are individually positive. The contribution of irreducible different Young diagrams is always positive. And it gets small. I can't prove that, but it gets small very quickly as you consider Young diagrams with non-dominating first row. And by summing over a few of the terms that they can compute, you can get the following lower bound for the moments of permanence, which is a prefactor, just 1.6 13 over 8 times the quantity that we derive using the intuitive results and intuitive argument. And just remind you that this number, the k factor to the power of t factor to the power of 2k divided by kt factorial, is actually growing extremely fast. It's a huge number. When you consider even moderate size t and k, is growing faster than factorial. So it's a good, getting it more or less right by a small constant prefactor is kind of good. And yeah, so this is one of the lower bounds that we prove. And as I said,
we got a question from Sam Winnick.
Open the chat.
So I was wondering, so your intuitive argument about the identity element, does this suggest that there could be a naming convention where for the elements of the group STK whereby you can give a unique you can assign a unique word to each one of these elements that's like R1, C1, R2, C2, but not actually get all of those words? And that's sort of the first question, and I have a follow-up question.
Yeah, so this is actually a very, very good question. I spent some time on that. I couldn't, this is a brilliant idea, I think, if you could actually do that. The best thing I could prove is that any permutation can be written in terms of row preserving time, column preserving time, row preserving permutation. So it can be written as RCR or equivalently CRC. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's unique for the. So naming convention is not unique. I don't think there's a bijection between just like these tables and any permutation. I think it's a bit more complex. Yeah. And so
what were you going to say?
And I just saying the fact that you don't get the intuitive on result and you get it by where am I going? You get it by prefactor means that the weight is not uniform, at least near the origin you have more weight than some other places in the distribution.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering if there was a bijection not between STK and the set of all of these words of the form R1, C1, R2, C2, but a subset of these words that uniquely where each one of these words actually gives you that element. I was wondering if it would be possible to then try to use this bijection in the calculation that you have on the previous slide, I think from here, where you were just using these on the next slide. One where you're looking at these different shapes of Young diagrams. Do you think it's conceivable that you could try to use some sort of bijection to aid these calculations?
I don't know, but I among the things that I would like to understand more, this is probably the most conceivable thing to just like, I mean, honestly, I don't know, but I think it's pretty reasonable to find that the exact bijection doesn't work, but something in the same sense probably would. I mean, there's no exact bijection, but it could be something close to that. And I think this is very promising.
Interesting. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Yes, it's just to follow up, just back up my conjecture. So we can use some algorithm. It's not really a fancy algorithm, but you can just actually compute this ratio of permanent to the power of 2t divided by k factorial to the power of 2k, t factorial to the power of 2t divided by kt factorial. You can actually compute it exactly for, say, k equal to 3, meaning the matrices of 3 by 3 matrices, and for power for t smaller than 100. And by size moment dualities, same for, you can actually swap size and moment. So it would be the sixth moment of the matrices of sizes 1 to 100. And you can see that the blue line here is the exact result. And the red line is the lower bound that you can collect by just collecting like 10 terms in the expansion. You can do the similar thing for the 4 by 4 matrices, or the eighth moment of matrices of increasing size. And you can see that again, this is the universal, the lower bound that I was talking about, to the red line, the 13 over 8 times k factorial to the power of 2 tt factorial to the power of 2k divided by kt factorial. And the blue dots are exact results. So you can see that it seems like the numerical experiments kind of confirm this conjecture. And in the paper, I provide this conjecture that the lower bound is actually close to the exact value. And this motivates us to actually make the following conjecture, that the permanent, this maybe is the permanent moment growth conjecture, that tells you that the average of permanent to the power of 2t divided by this prefactor is always smaller than 2, and it quickly approaches the asymptotic constant as we increase k and t. And I provide a bit more evidence for this conjecture in the paper as well, but the point is that along with our lower bound, so this is kind of an upper bound. So along with this lower bound, it really identified all moments of permanence up to a small multiplicative factor. And one application, if you believe in this conjecture, one application would be computing the some kind of concentration results on the permanent distribution. So you can look at the log permanence. So it's a normal thing to look at the log of these kind of quantities for the determinant. People look at the log of the determinant because permanent and determinant have heavy tails, and it's better to look at the log. And you can use the standard techniques in large deviation theory along with our moment bounds to actually see how the permanent really decays as you increase the matrix size. And I think this is the first explicit calculation of the tail of a random permanent distribution. And something that you can immediately see is that comparing to the random determinants, permanents have a much, much heavier tail. So they behave qualitatively very differently for large values. And as I said before, this doesn't work for anti-concentration conjecture because I'm getting the other side of the distribution. If you are interested in the distribution near the origin as you're interested in anti-concentration, you need way more accurate information about the moments. And because I'm near the end of my time, I will quickly go through the case of submatrices of random unitary matrices. So in that case, so again, you have this large unitary random unitary, hard random unitary matrix. You look at its a submatrix of that. And the combinatorial approach doesn't work anymore, but you can use representation theory directly to prove a similar expansion formula. So this was for the Gaussian case. Now it's for the random submates a random unitary case, and you get different prefactors, and this particular prefactor is a dimension of the EREFs of the unitary group. But the fun fact is that it has more or less a similar form. You, by computing this particular terms, you can actually compute the averages of the minors of a random unitary matrices after the permanent of random unitary matrices. And you can see that this formula, again, explicitly has this size moment duality. You can change size and swap size and moment, and doesn't change the value of the moment. And in this case, we can also compute some moment lower bounds. And one particular lower bound that they can prove is actually matches, is for the case of, for the case where the we are looking at the minor of the random unitary matrix is the whole unitary matrix. So if you're interested in the permanent of random unitary matrices, not their minor, it's just the whole random unitary matrices, you can prove in this strong lower bound, which actually matches a conjectured value of the permanent moments by Nick Hunter-Jones. So Nick, it's conjectured that if M is a random unitary matrix, then permanent of M to the power of 2T is almost equal to T factorial divided by this number to the power of T. And we can actually prove this quantity as a lower bound. And for the case of random unitary matrices, you can see that the errors of the lower bound and the exact cases that we compute is actually much smaller. It's less than 1%, even if you look at the 4x4 unitary matrices. Sorry, I'm going a bit fast because I'm near end of my time, but the basic message here is that the same technology works for the other limit. But instead of random Gaussian matrices, you look at random unitary matrices. You prove lower bounds again, and the lower bounds turn out to be very good. And in that case, it might be even easier to prove things because this moment conjecture is actually matches this moment information. The value of the moment is exactly equal to moments of an exponential distribution. It really suggests that the permanent of random unitary matrices are distributed with an exponential distribution. They have an exponential distribution. And I suspect that the case of permanent of random unitary matrices should be much easier than the permanent of actual random Gaussian matrices. So I will end with some comments on the entropy concentration. So as I said, sadly, we couldn't get the distribution near the origin. I think for getting the distribution near the origin, you need to have a much better precision than what I already have. So I can estimate the moments up to a small multiplicative factor. But if you want to actually go to figure out the distribution near the origin, you probably need an analytic formula for the moments or something much, much stronger. And sadly, I don't have that accuracy yet. And there is one more obstacle, and that is the Schluchz moment problem, which tells you that in many cases, even if you have all integer moments of a distribution, you cannot uniquely determine the distribution from that moment information. And that is usually happening when you have a very heavy tail distribution. And I think this is more or less the case for the distribution permanent. So you may need some more assumptions about smoothness or something about the distribution to get the anticoncentration, even if you have all the moments, exactly, all the integer moments, exactly. And with that, I end with a quick summary of the results and some future directions. So the first step towards understanding distribution of permanent of random matrices, we assert a random permanent moment in two scenarios, permanent of random complex Gaussian matrices and permanence of minors of random unitary matrices. We prove strong lower bounds for all moments of permanence and argue that the lower bounds are tight up to a small factor. And we compute the tail of log permanent distribution using our conjecture, of course, and prove the size moment duality. And I didn't talk about it, but we had an algorithm computing the permanent moment of small matrices. And there are some interesting open questions. One is, of course, to prove the conjectured upper bound for the moments. It may not be that hard, but I don't know how to do it. And or it could be possible. I mean, there are signs that it could be possible to really package the terms that appear in the expansion formula in some analytic way. So individual terms are not analytic, but analytic in K in the moment or in the matrix size. But if you can tweak that and slightly package them in an analytic way, then you would be able to approach the to get more accurate estimates of the moment of the distribution near the origin. I could talk about it, but if someone asks me questions, I will talk about it a little further. But now I'll stop. Thank you. Sorry, I went a bit beyond the time.
Okay, let's all thank Jeff for a really great talk. We had plenty of questions during. But if there are any others, please go ahead. Okay, since you said you could talk a bit more about it, I'd like to hear more about this open question about packaging the terms in the expansion formula, please.
Yeah. So, for example, the way that you prove anti-concentration for the determinants of random complex matrices is by looking at the moments, but looking at the slightly negative moments. So you look at minus moment k equal to minus 1 over 10 or 1 over n. So you analytically continue your moment calculation to slightly negative numbers. And so it could be the case that individual terms that appear in your expansion formula, if you just like add them together or just package them a little bit, they become analytic in K or T. So all of them are analytic functions of K, but in certain limited regimes. But if you could just play with them and become analytic, so it's, you could be able to extend this, you could be able to study this sum term by term near the zeroth moment. And that would also resolve the anti-concentration conjecture. But these are all speculations. So these are things that I've tried a little bit. More or less looked promising, but I couldn't finish them. But,
okay, thanks. Are there any more questions? Okay, let's thank Sepa again for a really nice talk.
Thanks so much for inviting, Chris.